Chapter 27. Robert Hedrock returned to his office in the Hotel Royal Ganil shortly after midday. He examined the reports that had come in during his absence, then spent 2 hours on a private telestat with an economic expert at the Weapon Shop Information Center. Then he called the members of the Weapon Makers Council and requested an immediate plenary session. It required about 10 minutes for the full council to assemble in the council chambers of the hotel. Dresley opened the meeting. "Looks to me, gentlemen," he said, "as if our coordinator has struck a warm trail. Right, Mr. Hedrock?" Hedrock came forward smiling. Last time, in speaking to a delegation of this council, he had had the pressures of the time map and the Empress upon his spirit. The map was still in the building, its problem unsolved, becoming more urgent every hour. But now he had one solution. He began without preliminary. "Gentlemen, on the morning of November 27th, 12 days hence, we will send a message to the Isher Empress and request her to end her war. We will accompany our request with facts and figures that will convince her she has no alternative." He expected a sensation, and he got it. These men knew that when it came to his job, he was not one to raise false hopes. They had yet to discover that his efficiency was equally great in other fields. Feet stirred, and there was excitement. Peter Cadran said explosively, "Man, don't keep us in suspense. What have you discovered?"
"Permit me," said Hedrock, "to recapitulate." He went on. "Are you aware on the morning of June 3rd, 4784 Isher, a man from the year 1951 A.D. appeared in our Greenway weapon shop? The discovery was then made that the Empress was directing a new energy weapon against all Imperial City weapon shops. This energy was a form of atomic power, old in nature but new to science. Its discovery heralds another step forward in our understanding of the complex structure of the space-time tensions that make for the existence of matter. The source of the energy in Imperial City was a building completed about a year ago and located on Capitol Avenue. Its effect on the Greenway shop differed from its effect on shops further away. Theoretically, it should have destroyed any material structure instantly. But though Isher rulers have never known it, weapon shops are not made of matter in the accepted sense. And so there was an intricate interplay of gigantic forces that took place predominantly in time itself. And so a man came 700 years out of the past." He described briefly, using pure mathematical terms, the seesaw action of the man and the building once they were launched into the abyss of time. He went on. "There are still people who cannot understand how there can be a time swing when it is a macrocosmic fact that the sun and its planets move steadily through space-time at 12 plus miles a second, in addition to which the planets follow an orbital course around the sun at varying speeds. By this logic, it should follow that if you go into the past or future, you will find yourself at some remote point in space, far from Earth. It is hard for people who think this to realize that space is a fiction, a byproduct of the basic time energy, and that a matter tension like a planet does not influence phenomena in the time stream, but is itself subject to the time energy laws. The reason for balancing 2 hours and 40 minutes after every swing is obscure, but it has been suggested that nature unrelentingly seeks stability. The building, when it swings into the past, occupies the same space as it did in normal time, but there are no repercussions, for the reason that similarity is a function of time itself, not of its tension product. McAllister started at 7,000 years, the building at 2 seconds. That is approximate. Today, the man is several quadrillions of years away, and the building swings at a distance of somewhat less than 3 months. The fulcrum, of course, moves forward in our time, so that we have the following situation. The building no longer swings back in time as far as June 3rd, where the seesaw originally started. Please bear these facts in mind while I turn briefly to another division of this seemingly complicated but basically simple business." Hedrock paused. There were quick minds in this room. It interested him to see that every face was still expectant. Now that he himself knew the truth, it seemed queer that they had not yet grasped the reality. He continued, "Gentlemen, the coordination department discovered some months ago that there existed in the village of Glay a calidetic giant. With so much internal pressure pushing him, we had no difficulty maneuvering him into coming to Imperial City. At first, our belief that he would influence events markedly was nullified by his ignorance of Isher realities. I won't go into the details, but he was shipped to Mars as a common laborer. He was able to return almost immediately. He went on to explain how Lucy Rawl had been married to one Cale Clark a few hours before the arrival of the ship that brought Cale Clark back to Earth, how the two Clarks secured 500,000 credits, then visited Colonel Medlin, one of them disguised. The visit was a fortunate one for Medlin. He had just been asked by the Empress to produce Clark or else. A captaincy was conferred on Clark with the usual hypnotic machine training for officers. The following day, he reported to the Empress. For a reason which she considers to have been impulse, but which is traceable to his callidity, she attached him to her personal staff, and he is there now. Wherever his influence extends, he has followed a very interesting pattern of ruthlessly eliminating the more obvious corruption, and this has roused the interest of the ambitious Inelda. Even if nothing else worked in his favor, he would appear to be a young man destined to go far in the Imperial service. Then Hedrock smiled. Actually, the Cale Clark to watch is not the one in the open, but the one who remained elusively in the city. It is that Clark who has been making history since last August 7th. In the time since then, he has achieved the following successes. And gentlemen, I warn you, you've never heard anything like this before. In a few sentences, he described what had happened. When he had finished, the table buzzed with excited discussion. At last, a man said, "But why marry Lucy Rawl?" "Partly love, partly..." Hedrock hesitated. He had asked Lucy a pointed question, and her answer made his reply possible now. "I would say he grew immensely cautious and began to think of the future. Basic urges came to the fore. Suppose something happened to a man who in a few weeks had accomplished the miracle that he had. Gentlemen, he wanted an heir, and Lucy was the only honest girl he knew. It may be a permanent arrangement, I cannot say. Clark, in spite of his rebellion against his parents, is essentially a well-brought-up young man. In any event, Lucy will not suffer. She will have the interesting experience of having a child. And as a wife, she has community property rights." Peter Cadran climbed to his feet. "Gentlemen," he said, "I move a vote of thanks to Robert Hedrock for the service he has rendered the weapon shops." The applause was prolonged. "I move further," said Peter Cadran, "that he be given the rank of unrestricted member." Once more, there were no dissenters. Hedrock bowed his appreciation. The reward was more than an honor. As an unrestricted member, he would be subject only to the P sub P machine examinations. His movements and actions would never be scrutinized, and he could use every facility of the shops as if they were his own property. He had been doing that anyway, but in future there would be no suspicion. It was a mighty gift. "Thank you, gentlemen," he said when the clapping ended. "And now," said Peter Cadran, "I respectfully request Mr. Hedrock to leave the council room while we discuss our remaining problem, the seesaw." Hedrock went out gloomily. He had momentarily forgotten that the greatest danger remained.